Thank you for joining us today for a message from the Word of God. What follows is a recording from one of our live services at Gooch Lane Church of Christ in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you join us in person. And if you like what you hear today, you can visit us online at teachingtruth.org, where we have videos, weekly articles on biblical topics, information about our services, and more.
For the past several weeks, we've been following Jesus' road to coronation. And we've done that primarily from the book of Matthew. So we began this by looking at his baptism, how that Jesus, as the better Moses, is getting with his people. He's leading his people into this covenant, back into the covenant with God. We noted then how that immediately after his baptism, the Spirit drives him into the wilderness, where he undergoes all of this testing with no miracles. There's nothing he's doing that would really differ from what you and I could do, with the exception that he stayed faithful. He didn't fall to any of those temptations, always quoting. And it's interesting that when he did that, he's quoting from the words of Moses in the book of Deuteronomy. And then last week we looked at the king's mountain call, where as Moses went into the wilderness and up on the mountain, Jesus goes through the wilderness up on the mountain, but then the people follow him, unlike they did with Moses. With no fire, no smoke, Jesus sits down and he teaches them the constitution of his kingdom. And so today we move into a very unique account. I suppose for many of us who grew up with the Bible, going through all these stories, we can allow them, if we're not careful, to become rather commonplace and to say, oh yes, the transfiguration, that's when Moses and Elijah appeared to Jesus, now let's move on. And to fail to see just how odd this account is. What we're told here, very unusual, but yet extremely significant. And so that's what I'd like to focus on this morning. And if you'll note with me, it says in verse 1, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up to a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. Have you ever been watching a TV show? And right at the beginning, there is this extremely intense scene. Maybe it's somebody hanging off the side of a building or something like that. And you're wondering, okay, is my hero going to fall to his death here? And the screen will go black and it'll say something like 6 days earlier. And then you go back in time and you begin to retrace what's going on. I think that's how Matthew's writing this account. 6 days earlier, he says, something has happened, because it's after those 6 days that the transfiguration takes place. Let's explore that just a minute. One thing we certainly need to keep in mind is that Matthew has not dropped the Moses link here. He's still working to let Jesus walk, in a sense, in the steps of Moses, but yet showing him so superior. And it should be no surprise to us that when we look back to the book of Exodus, we find this in chapter 24, verse 16. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. So here's Moses with a 6-day preview as well. We go just a little bit further in Exodus, and we find that Moses came down from Mount Sinai, this is in chapter 34, with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. And as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone, because he had been talking with God. So again, keep Matthew in mind here, what he's doing. 6 days with Moses, 6 days with Jesus. Jesus' face shines, Moses' face had shone as well. But here's really why I think Matthew is doing this. He's linking this back to what's just happened. One of the unusual things about the transfiguration account is the prominent role Peter plays in it. I don't know if you've ever thought about that or not. We'll bring this out here in a few minutes, but there's three quotes in the transfiguration account, and Peter's is the very first one. So here we find Matthew really honing us in on Peter. So if we back up to chapter 16, what's happened 6 days earlier? What's been going on? Well, one of the big things we find in that chapter is that Peter gives this great confession of Jesus. Jesus says, "Who do men say that I am?" Laundry list of names come up, but we look down to verse 16. And Jesus has said, "Who do you say that I am?" Talking to his apostles. Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And the other accounts kind of drop it there, but Matthew goes on to give Jesus praise for this answer. "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." And then goes on to make the statement, "You're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." So surprising, isn't it, that just a few verses down, we have another quote of Peter. Jesus has said, "I've got to go to Jerusalem, and there I'm going to suffer many things, and I'm going to die." We look at verse 21 as he tells them all of this. Verse 22, Peter replies, taking him aside and rebuking him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." Just like in the temptation account, you've got Peter who's saying, "There's a shortcut here. You don't have to do this." Which then, unsurprisingly, elicits the rebuke of Jesus. Verse 23, he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance for me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Jesus is going to go further then. And he's going to say to his apostles a little bit about what's going to take place here. And I want us to note two things in verses 27 and 28. He says, "For the Son of Man is going to come with His angels." And here's the point I want us to hone in on right now. In glory. Keep that word in mind. "With His angels in the glory of His Father, and He will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom." Now Matthew is huge on this idea of kingdom concept, and right here, before we get to the transfiguration, he's mentioned glory and he's mentioned that coming kingdom. So with that as our backdrop, let's think about what happens now 6 days later. Peter has given this great confession. Peter has also given a terrible statement. He's been rebuked for that. Jesus has said what's going to take place, and now we come to this very unusual event where he's transfigured. I want you to note with me something going on here. We look again at verse 1, and it says he takes these three and he leads them up on a high mountain. That's an interesting term. You go back to the prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, you'll find high mountain very much associated with the coming of God. That's not where I want us to go this morning, though. In fact, we're going to just back up a very few chapters. Because in Matthew chapter 4, that third temptation, it says the devil took him, Jesus, to a very high mountain. Notice the parallel there. You have Jesus taking the three apostles up on a high mountain. Here you've got the devil taking Jesus up on a high mountain. And he showed him all the kingdoms of the world, and in particular, their glory. I don't think that's an accident that it's written this way. That here you have the devil saying, "Look at all of the splendor of earth. Look at all of these kingdoms of earth. Look at their glory." And so Matthew's kind of lining these two things up for us here so that we can see in the temptations, there is this great highlighting of the humanity of Jesus. Right? No miracles are taking place. He's not calling fire from heaven. He's not making bread out of rocks. Nothing like that. He is confronting temptation like every human can and should. His humanity. But here on the Mount of Transfiguration, There is a key emphasis on his deity. What these three are going to see is something very big going on as his glory is going to be revealed to them. Now let's again pay particular attention to that word glory. You look at that word throughout the Bible, and oftentimes it's used almost synonymously with light. You'll find glory and light, the glory shone out. Well, that's no accident. Because from the very beginning to the very end, you've got light associated with God. We know the beginning quite well, don't we? God said, "Let there be light." I think there's a lot going on in that statement, don't you? It's not just He's turning the lights on. He's saying, the glory is entering this place. God is coming in. And so you find the light there. And then as we get on into Revelation, we find in that initial vision of Jesus as the Christ in all of His glory, it says in chapter 1, verse 16, in His right hand He held the seven stars, and from His mouth came the two-edged sword, and His face was like the sun, shining in full strength. Compare that to what you see in verse 2 of chapter 17. And His face shone like the sun. No doubt what John and Matthew are doing here. They're saying, we're letting you see the glory of God. And oh, by the way, this was the light that made Moses' face shine. We do not say that Jesus' face shined like Moses. No. Jesus is the source of that light. That when Moses went up on the mountain and he would come on, he had been in the presence of this one. And now the three apostles are being given that vision. They're being shown exactly what's going on. Think about the blessing they had. These three apostles are taken up on the mountain and they are shown that this man is much more than some backwoods teacher. This man is much more than some philosopher who's come along. Who they are seeing is God. Who they're seeing is deity. And that's what we find in this glory being revealed to them. Now, very unusually, we find that as all of this is going on, it seems like suddenly out of nowhere, Moses and Elijah show up. Why is that? Why do these two come? Well, let me remind us something that we noted with the temptation account. I believe this is a literal story. I don't think it's just simply some story that's made up. But yet it's got that quite apocalyptic air to it. Remember we said with the temptations, Jesus was in the wilderness, yet He's in Jerusalem, yet He's on the mountain, all these things going on. And so here they are, they're on a mountain, and yet all of a sudden we've got Moses and Elijah showing up. Just a few verses down in verse 9, Jesus will actually call this a vision. So I don't think the whole thing is, but certainly an aspect of it was. And so He alludes to that. So here we find, again, a similarity that we had with Moses. So way back in Exodus, when Moses goes up on the mountain, it says he goes into the cloud, and it's as if he's entering this realm where heaven and earth meet, very much like Eden. So here he is, he's in this place that's not really heaven, that's not really earth, that really is heaven, that really is earth. So let your mind chew on that a little while. And now Peter, James, and John are in that same situation. And as they see Jesus with His glory being revealed, His face shining, His clothes becoming bright white, here we find Moses, and here we find Elijah. And what we're going to learn from the book of Luke is what they talk about. So I'm going to stray from Matthew here for just a minute. Over in Luke chapter 9, verse 31, it says, "Behold, two men were talking with Him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory," interesting, "and spoke of His departure." You know what that word is. That word is Exodus. He spoke to him of His exodus. Again, keeping that Moses line going. So here they are, they're talking about His final act here in this plan of salvation, which He was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. That's absolutely amazing. And so if you're like me, the question then comes up, why these two? Of all the people in the Old Testament, why do we have Moses and Elijah? So what verse can we turn to answer that question in black and white terms? We cannot. And thus, there have been lots of speculations, and I guess I'm going to add to that bandwagon just a little bit this morning. But the standard answer is, well, Moses represented the law, Elijah represented the prophets, so here's the law and the prophets. I'm not opposed to that idea. I think there's a lot of truth in it. I'm afraid, though, if we stop there, that we're missing some other significant things. So very, very quickly, this is just for you to chew on at a later point. Let's talk a little bit about some of these similarities. The very last two Old Testament people mentioned in the last book written of the Old Testament are guess who? It's Moses and Elijah. If you want to keep your place here in Matthew and just back up to Malachi, just a few pages back to chapter 4, we're going to find that. In Malachi chapter 4, so here's Malachi, he's writing this very short prophecy. We come down to the end of it in verse 4 of chapter 4. He says, "Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and rules that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction." Let me just make this little note because we're going to be back to it here in a minute. The apostles knew their Hebrew Bible. They knew it. And so here in this very last prophecy, Malachi is saying, yeah, think about Moses, think about Elijah. So I think that's very significant. I think there's a couple of other things too for also comparing. Both Moses and Elijah have a time where they're calling Israel into covenant loyalty. Sinai for Moses, and then as Elijah takes on the prophets of Baal, he's calling all Israel to the mountain to watch. So here they are, they're calling for covenant fidelity, loyalty, both of them from a mountain. We find also that both witnessed God in very unusual ways, didn't they? Moses went into the cloud. What about Elijah on that mountain where he's taking on the prophets of Baal? Fire falls from heaven. And then when Elijah is having a very bad season in his life, he has this conversation with God there on a mountain also. And then one other thing, just to quickly note, is both of them had very unusual situations at their death. You had Moses, who was taken by God and buried. Nobody to this day knows where he's buried. You had Elijah, who saw the chariots of fire and then taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. So I think when you look at why these two appear, certainly they represent, in a sense, the law and the prophets, but there is a whole host of things going on here as to why they were significant. Now, I would love if Matthew had stopped and told us all about that. Wouldn't you like to know that conversation that took place? Here's Moses and Elijah and Jesus having this conversation, but we're going to turn our attention to Peter. And you think of all the things we could have known, why is it that the Holy Spirit is directing Matthew to say, don't say anything about this conversation? Focus in on Peter. Thus we find, as we mentioned earlier, of the three quotes, here's Peter with the very first one. He's seeing all of this going on, and as he looks at this situation, he says, "Lord, it is good for us to be here." I agree with that quote, don't you? I hope that's something I would have said. This is tremendous. What we're being allowed to see. No real speculation about that part, but he doesn't stop. He goes on and he says, "Tell you what, I'm going to build three booths. One for you, one for Elijah, one for Moses. I'm going to build those right here on top of the mountain. Now our question is, why did he say that? We're given at least part of the answer by Mark. So we're going to drop out of Matthew just a minute, go to Mark, and Mark says, oh, he said this because he was scared to death. It's kind of like Mark's writing all this and he punches us in the ribs and he says, he didn't know what he was saying. He was so scared. Right? Can you imagine that conversation maybe as Mark is interviewing Peter? He's saying, tell me about this. And Peter says, we were terrified. We didn't know what was going on. But I guess my question is that all? That even in a state of fear, this is an unusual statement. To say, let's stop everything and let me build three booths. Again, a lot of speculation's gone into that. Let's look at one line of thought maybe that doesn't get the prominence of the others. There's a lot of association with the Feast of Booths and the Day of the Lord. Remember that passage we read in Malachi? When he says, when the day of the Lord comes, Elijah's going to come, he's going to prepare the way. So Malachi has linked Elijah and the day of the Lord together. I want to note with you one other prophet that I think helps us out here, and that's the prophet Zechariah. Chapter 14, I'm just going to look at two verses here. The lead-off verse of this section says, behold, the day is coming for the Lord. So the day of the Lord is coming when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. And then he gives some explanation. Verse 16, everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths. There is a ring of the Day of the Lord and the Feast of Booths joined together here in Zechariah. Remember what I said earlier? The apostles knew the Hebrew Bible. They knew these prophets. And so here's Peter. By the way, you remember the last quote of Peter 6 days earlier? Lord, stop. None of this has got to happen. You do not have to go to Jerusalem and die. You don't have to do that. And so I offer this simply for your consideration that maybe the reason Peter's making this statement is because he's thinking, I'm going to get my wish. Because maybe here on this mountain is the beginning of the kingdom. We've got Elijah, we've got Moses kind of in the cheerleading section over here, we've got Jesus shining like the sun. Maybe he's not going to have to die after all. And with that, we have our second quote coming about, which would be even more terrifying. Because as all of this is going on, it says a cloud comes. And after Peter makes his statement, it says, the voice spoke. And this voice says almost the same thing that was said at Jesus' baptism. This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. But he adds three words, at least in English. Listen to him. Oftentimes we read that and we say, oh yes, Peter's being told, you don't listen to Moses and Elijah anymore, right? That their time is gone. Well, to an extent that's true. I'm a somewhat simplistic thinker. So I take this statement at face value as a response to Peter. You ever told your kids, be quiet and listen to what I'm telling you? When do you say that? It's when they're coming up with all the alternative plans, right? You've told them it's going to be this way, but this is better. We need it. Be quiet and listen. Isn't that what Peter's being told? Peter has said, oh, you don't have to go to Jerusalem. You don't have to die there. This can be handled in a different way. And if he's got this thought in mind, well, this is it. This is the Feast of Booths. I'm right. Here God is saying, listen, the Son is telling you what you need to hear. This plan is leading to Jerusalem. It must lead to Jerusalem. It must lead to His death for it to be consummated. Which then leads us to the third quote. But let's set that quote up a bit. Because just as out at Mount Sinai, it says the apostles were terrified of this voice. You remember the people at Sinai? Chapter 20 of Exodus, verse 18, when the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled as they stood afar. And now here's the apostles watching all of this, and it says they were afraid. And yet Jesus is going to come to them with His third quote, taps them, they look up, He's back to how they're used to seeing Him. And He says, have no fear. Well, there's still an echo chamber going on here. Because as the people were terrified at Sinai, Moses said to the people, do not fear. For God has come to test you, that the fear of Him may be before you, that you may not sin. But there's one extreme difference here. This time, the command to not fear is not given through a mediator. It's God speaking Himself. This one that they just witnessed in this transfigured state with His face shining and His clothes bright now says to them, you got nothing to be scared about. And what a comfort those words must have been to them. Now, this has to be recorded for a reason, doesn't it? That here some 2,000 years later, we're looking at this very unusual account, and we could go for a really long time in answering why that is. But I want to leave you with just two things to take away from it. One of those is simply this. We got to understand who it is we serve. We got to know who it is. We might think, well, of course, we're here this morning. We're sitting in hot weather under a tent so we can hear about it. I'm not so sure we get it like we need to. Sometimes we tend to do a lot of focusing on the human side of Jesus. We spend a lot of time in the Gospels. We talk about His words and we talk about His interactions and how He showed compassion and all of these wonderful things. And that's important, and we must see His humanity because that was essential for the plan of salvation. But that must never veil His glory. That as we think about who it is we're here to serve this morning, that like those apostles, we can understand that this was a whole lot more than some rabbi. The words we have recorded aren't some backwoods philosopher who was in Galilee 2,000 years ago. This was the Son of God who is given in His full glory there in Revelation, as we looked at just earlier. And with that, perhaps comes the more important point. We must remember who we serve. I bring that out because of these three apostles. They saw something nobody else at that time was able to see. They saw Jesus for who He was, and that was going to be a testimony on down the road, but they're given this great opportunity. It was good for them to be there. But what happens at the crucifixion? What happens at the crucifixion? Do they stand boldly at the foot of the cross and say, we saw Him for who He was? Now, I understand Jesus had said, don't talk about this till after my resurrection. They'd been given commands. But yet in their minds, they knew who it was. They knew who was hanging on that cross. But what happened? In the face of fear, Jesus' command, don't be scared, do not fear. That's replaced with the fear of the beast and all those little folks working for him at the scene, the Roman governors and the Jewish leaders, people nailing him to a cross. And they became terrified at their peers when the one that they serve had said, "You don't have to fear." Believe me, I do not speak in judgment on them in that regard. I believe I scarcely would have done much better than they did, if at all. Because what we see then, and really throughout time, is that fear can oftentimes deter righteousness. You tell someone, if you say that, you're going to prison. Most of the time they'll stop saying it. You tell someone, you say that again, you're going to be put to death, the words will not be spoken. Fear is a strong emotion. And this account is illustrating that in a couple of ways. But as we look at these apostles, at what they saw, and yet the reaction not terribly long afterwards, we understand that danger. They forgot who they served. They forgot who it was that they had seen. And so perhaps one of the reasons God has chosen to give us this account is so that we can remember in those times of fear who is in control. You see, it's so easy when we can meet together and we can worship God and there's nobody who's trying to stop us from that. There's no false teachers. There's no soldiers. Nobody's trying to stop that from happening. And we can say we are tough. We are people who are invincible. But yet we look at this account and we see what happened to three who had sat at the feet of Jesus listening to Him teach. And it's a warning to us. Let me mention just one other thing. To understand who we serve, it requires us to be quiet and to listen. There are times when we think we know better. If you've never had those times, I suspect you're deceiving yourself. You read some account in the Bible. Why would God do this? Why would God let this happen? Why would God allow these people to die? Why would God allow this bad thing to happen to people who are serving Him? Why is God so vitriolic toward the enemies? And we think, you know, the better answer is, it's at that point we need to stop. We need to ask ourselves, why is my solution better than God's? What if I was in the driver's seat and I said, "Oh, God shouldn't have done that. He should have done this." What would the end result of that be? When you take a finite mind with a limited understanding, minuscule understanding, and you say, "My plan better than God's plan." May I suggest to you, when we start traveling down that road, it's time to be quiet and to listen to Him. Sometimes He'll explain Himself, sometimes He explains about Himself. He may not give the answer to your question, but He may tell you who He is. And so as that voice from the mountain spoke to these three, that voice speaks to us and says, just be quiet. Listen to what He's saying. And while you may not be able to understand everything, you can understand Him. You can understand who He is. And that His ways are right. And so with that, we look at Jesus here in this brief picture of glory. But yet it makes us dream for that day when we're going to be in the presence of that light. But the only way we're going to see the glory then is if somehow we can see it now. That doesn't mean by Him coming and being transfigured by any means. But it means understanding Him and who He is. And trusting that if I'm faithful to Him, I'll see that glory forever. That comes when you confess His name before men. You do not fear. You say, come what may, I believe Jesus is the Son of God. He died for my salvation. And I believe in the waters of baptism that the Lord's going to forgive my sins when He sees my faith. And I can trust His grace that He'll do that. If you're ready to do that this morning, I hope you will. We're going to stay seated during the invitation song, but if you're ready, you stand up and come forward and let that good confession ring out and see the glory of Jesus Christ in your salvation. If it's dimmed, you are like the rest of us. How many times have we not listened? But if that's led you down a road you don't like the destination of and you're ready to turn back, we'll pray with you this morning. Come forward, let your voice be heard. Or if you're just struggling, the voice may seem rather distant, the Lord may seem rather distant, you just need a prayer for strength, come forward, let your voice be heard. And we'll pray together and then we'll be quiet. And we'll let the Lord do His work. If you need to respond, you can come as we sing together.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have questions about anything you heard today or anything Bible related, you can use the contact form on our website at teachingtruth.org to submit a question and someone will be in touch. There's also lots of other great Bible content on our site as well. The web address again is teachingtruth.org. Once again, thanks for listening and we hope to see you in person soon.